Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
If we could have a word of prayer before I begin. So let's bow our head. Father in heaven, I just thank you for the opportunity to speak about your word together. And I pray that you'd help all of us to understand and learn and grow. And I pray this that you'd be with my words. And in your name, amen. Okay, so this passage is actually quite difficult for me and gave me a lot of trouble when I was an early Christian, and I hope that it won't give you too much trouble either. But that last verse about 1 John 3:23, and this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son Jesus Christ and love one another as he gave us commandment. That's from the same Greek word for belief is used a lot in the New Testament, and it's pistuo, and it means to have conviction that something is true. It means to put trust in someone or to entrust something to someone. And so what I'm talking about today is like just what do we believe, and how do we know what we believe? And it turns out that we can believe things that we don't actually believe, and there are things that we need to be convinced of. For example, if I were to come to you and tell you that I miraculously healed my brother, you know, you believe that the Bible has healings in it and they're miraculous healings and stuff, but you know, you might have a hard time believing that I did something like that. You might go like, yeah, sure, you know, but I mean, can you show me the evidence? And I want to see the medical reports and I want to see all these other things. You might think I'm a bit of a crackpot or crazy or liar or something like that. And the same goes for bad things too. It's kind of interesting, you know, if some stranger walked by your window and peeked inside and said like, you're a terrible person and I hate you and you're so dumb and blah, 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 and they just started throwing a bunch of insults, you know, you'd probably be like stunned that there's some weirdo outside your window, but you probably wouldn't believe any of it. You'd probably be like, you know, who are you? Why should I care what you think? You know, get out of my yard and, you know, I'm going to call the police on you. But it's funny when it's a friend or a family member that says something hurtful to us. It's more painful because they know us, and that challenges something we believe about ourselves, and it's a little more painful. So it works that way. So what do we believe about the world, about life, and about God, and how will that determine what we do in the world? You know, what do we believe about God? What is God like? And that question is a really important question, and if we don't understand it, then we will be interacting with God in a way that isn't very helpful. So, for example, the parable of the talents, there was a wicked servant who buried his talent. And the first two servants, they took the talents that the master gave them, and they invested them, and they made more money, and they grew, and they prospered. And the one said that he went and buried it. And why did he bury it? I don't know if you remember this parable. He was afraid. He said, I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you had not sown, and so I went and I buried it. And so he believed that God was a hard man, and that God was not going to work with him, and that God was going to judge him harshly for what he couldn't produce well enough, and so he went and hid. So what we believe can keep us from growing, and it can keep us stagnant and cause us to do things like hide ourselves and hide the things that we're good at, hide the things that could actually grow God's kingdom and be a blessing to other people. We can hide those things if we don't believe good things about God. That's something that I'm always fascinated when we talk about Revelation 13, because when I first read about Revelation 13 in the seminars and stuff, I came into the church through seminars, and the biggest thing that you learn about Revelation 13 is it's about an entity. There's a certain religious political entity and organization that chapter is talking about, and I think that that's true. It is an organization, but it's an organization that behaved that way, and that there's a set of behaviors in that chapter that's described there that is still very alive and well, and we can be part of that system too, even though we're not part of that organization. What does the beast do? It forces people. It coerces people. It uses fear, It tells you you won't be able to buy or sell if you don't receive the mark. And you have to receive the mark in your forehead or in your right hand. And the beast power doesn't care how it operates. It just wants you to have it in your hand. So either carrying out the beast's bidding or in your mind, in your forehead. So the beast doesn't care about the whole person, whereas God cares about the whole person. He wants us to be fully united with him in not just in our mind and in our beliefs, but also in our behavior. So it's a radically different system that's being described in Revelation 13. And you can ask yourself, like, how will you behave if you think God is a tyrant? If you believe God is a tyrant, if you believe bad things about God, how will you behave? We already know that because we're tyrants with ourselves sometimes. So I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but we can be a tyrant to ourselves. Like, have you ever set impossible standards for yourself that you knew you weren't going to be able to do? You know, have you ever been really hard on yourself and punished yourself cruelly for something and told yourself, man, I was so stupid. It was stupid of me to do that. So stupid. And you just repeat something over and over to yourself about, you know, you go on this hamster wheel of misery, you know, or you just punish yourself. You know, you can be really down on yourself. And that has so much to do with what you believe, you know, for why you would do something. And, you know, like in this chapter is all about, it says, let us not love one another in words, but also in deeds. And there's like a inextricable link between what we believe and what we actually carry out and do with our bodies, with our hands. We believe, and then we behave in accordance with that belief. And so, you know, they mentioned there, like any good teacher, I think, does this. They talk about what something is. They talk about what is love. Love is about laying down your life for other people. And they also talk about what it isn't. And they give the example of Cain and Abel. And I talked about that the last time that I was here, but I did a little more research on Cain's name. I don't know if you've done this, but if you read Genesis 3, you've got the promise of the Messiah that they give to Eve. And then the very next thing in chapter 4 is she gives birth to Cain. And what does she say? She says, you know, she bore Cain and she named him Cain for I have gotten a man child from the Lord. That word gotten is this Hebrew word that's kana, and it means like to purchase or to procure or to own something. And the name Cain is related to that word. It shares like the same root, because the one word is kana, and Cain's name is Cain. Cain's name means to strike a note. It's a fixed note, like in a chant at a funeral or a wail, but it's the beginning of the chant, and it's fixed, and it has a purpose of getting everybody together on the same song. And it's another word for a lance as well. So you have to think about the hope that was in Eve when she gave birth to Cain, because he was a firstborn son, that this was going to be the Messiah that they were talking about, and that this was going to be a lance. Then when you look at the name of Abel, I don't know if you've done this, it's the same word from like the wind. It means emptiness or vanity. And figuratively, it means something that's transitory, meaning it's not permanent, it's just on its way through, and unsatisfactory. So you sort of think like Abel was the consolation prize, like, oh, another one. But Cain is where it's at. Cain is going to be the lance. He's going to be the one that's going to deliver us from the work of the devil. And so, but it turns out it's the exact opposite is what ended up happening. Abel ended up being humble and serving God and doing as God said, and God rewarded him, and then Cain didn't. But he felt entitled to God's blessing. He felt like, well, why am I not getting blessed? And God said, well, if you do well, you'll get blessed. It's not personal. It's not like, I hate you, Cain, and I want you to have a miserable life. But, you know, if you do well, then you'll be accepted. So, but sin lies at the door. So do something about that. And Cain felt entitled. And so what better way to act out that belief is to go and kill and to snuff out the life of the person who is actually good and worthwhile and doing the right thing and humble. It reminds me that there's something I read that, so we can be entitled, we can think that we're entitled to good things. And that's sort of, when you hear the word entitled, you think that that's typically what you think of, is somebody who like thinks that they deserve more than they should. And but there's also, you can also feel like you're entitled to bad things. And you probably know someone like that. I know someone that sends out deeply personal emails about all of their failings to you know, a huge list of people. It's like 70 people on the list. And they say things. I remember one email was like, I know why I'm single, you know, and I know why, you know, no one will marry me because I'm ugly and I'm just an ugly person and I'm ugly. And that's why I'm single. I'm thinking, you're sending this to like so many people. You're giving out like your deepest insecurities. But, you know, and when I heard that, when I read that email, I remember thinking like, who told you you were ugly? Who said a thing like that to you? You know, because that's really, I've met so many ugly people that are married. You know, not to be rude, but, you know, it's like being ugly or pretty, or I mean, I think most of us are pretty okay. You know, I mean, I'll speak for myself. I remember a comedian once saying, I think I'm a solid 5. You know, like I'm not going to be a lead in a movie, but I'm not terrible looking. And so I think like, who told you that you were ugly? I had a student once that and that's the question that God asks Adam in the garden. He says, who told you were naked? No, who told you that? You know, because God doesn't see us that way. And it's something wonderful about children. When you watch children play, they're just so darn goofy. They're just so comfortable in their body, and they haven't yet learned to be self-conscious yet. You know, but we learn, we grow older, we become aware of other people, and we become self-conscious, and then we start to, you know, doubt ourselves. And I had a student once that was just bombing out of my class, and I said, what's going on? Like, why are you not turning this in? You're not turning that in? You're not turning that in? Like, what's going on? And he said, well, I'm just lazy. And I was like, who told you that? I don't know. I'm just a lazy person, I guess. That's what I am. And I think, who told you you were lazy? Who did that? Who told you such a thing about yourself? Like, that's just who you are. You're just a lazy bum. You'll never make anything of yourself and you'll never get better. You're just a lazy bum. You're entitled to bad things. You know, it's the opposite side of entitlement. There's the entitlement to good things where you feel like, well, I deserve this. And why didn't God accept my sacrifice? And why didn't God give me good things? And why do they have to have a successful life? And why does that person have to have a nice car? And why does that person have to have a nice house? And so on and so forth. You know, there's that kind of entitlement. And then there's also the entitlement of like, I'm a worm and I'm worse than everybody. And I deserve to have my life miserable. And only bad things should happen to me. And it only makes sense that these bad things happen to me because that's what I deserve. And that's a kind of entitlement too. And to that I will tell you, why are you so deserving of bad things too? Like, give me some of that bad stuff too. You know, like, don't hoard it all and be greedy with all the bad things in life. Because the truth is, life really is full of things that will make you suffer. Everyone is going to suffer. That's the one thing that we can be sure of, is that none of us are making it out of this thing alive. And we're all going to suffer. Things are going to happen to us that we didn't plan on and that we don't want and that are truly awful things. You know, loved ones will die. Body parts will fail. You know, you will have financial trouble. It doesn't matter what you do. The suffering of life is unavoidable. And so how do we balance this? So there's like a paradox in the Bible. Like, we're worms, but we're valuable worms somehow. And so, you know, Romans 12:3 says, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to. And Romans 3:23 says, we've all fallen short of the glory of God. And I believe it's in Jeremiah or Isaiah that says, all our righteousness is as filthy rags. But then we're also children of the King. And it says in 1 John 3 that, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we shall be called the sons of God and daughters of God too, you know. So how do we accept our royalty without it going to our heads? And how do we accept our wormliness, for lack of a better word, without sinking into despair and hoping for the horrors of the world to happen to us and so on. So it really depends on what we believe and how we believe it and the degree to which you can kind of step out in faith. One of the hardest lessons that I've had to learn was to separate behavior from value. Because we really can't hate ourselves and live righteously. You just can't do that. We have to believe that we have value aside from what we're able to do and what we're able to give people, what we're able to accomplish, what we can earn as far as money. We have to believe that somewhere down inside of us is valuable. And this shouldn't be too hard to believe because we all have children. And for the most part, children aren't very useful. It's not until they get to be, you know, 6 or 7 where they can like help out around the house and clean up and stuff. But they're just so darn wonderful. Like I would never trade anything for my children. They're the most wonderful little creatures and little people that I've ever met. And I would die for them. I would give anything to have my children. And there's nothing anyone could offer me to trade for my children. If somebody came in with a suitcase full of money and said, "We would solve all of your financial troubles if you just give away one of your children," even the worst behaved this week, whoever's behaving the worst, who's just the nastiest kid to you this week, we'll give you this giant pile of money. And I would say absolutely not. And there's parts of that I would like to say, and I'm not going to say them in church. But I'm not going to. Absolutely not. There's no price that you could put on one of our children. So somehow, our children don't really do a lot for us as far as like helping out around the house. They get to the point where they can wash dishes and clean cat litter boxes and that kind of stuff. And that's really nice. But we don't love them because of what they can do. But somehow we forget that about ourselves, and we think, well, I better be doing, or else God doesn't love me, or my friends won't love me, or I won't be good enough, and I won't be acceptable enough. So somehow we forget that. So there's the value that we have in ourselves that we have to believe, and we also have to believe, that other people are valuable. And so, how do we treat people, and how do we treat ourselves when we don't believe that we're valuable? And that's something that I see with a lot of addicts. If you haven't known an addict, you're incredibly lucky. I will say this. I've got a friend that was in his 30s before he met his first alcoholic and had to actually deal with an alcoholic and the problems that an alcoholic has. And I just think like, wow, you made it 30 years. Like, you're really fortunate, But if you've ever dealt with an addict, one of the things that they talk about frequently is how much they hate themselves, like, and how much nobody loves them, and how much they don't deserve the love. They don't deserve good things. And going to an addict's funeral is even more heartbreaking because you see so many people at their funeral that loved that person and cared about them, but for whatever reason, while they were alive, they couldn't see it. Maybe because they didn't believe it. Maybe they didn't believe that was true. That why would somebody love me? Look at how much trouble I cause people. Why would anybody love me? So they get to the point where they're destroying themselves because they ask the question, why does it matter? Nobody loves me. In fact, they hate me, and I hate me. And so when you hate someone, you can pretty much do whatever you want to them, and that's what a person will do to themselves if you hate yourself. We think it's about substances, but really it's a crisis of identity and value and belief. It's like, who are you and what do you believe about the world? That's what's really going on. The addict doesn't believe that they're valuable, so then they can destroy themselves. You have to be able to do that. If you think about it like this, any one of us that's 21 or older could go to a Walmart or a Meijer or a CVS or a Walgreens and buy enough vodka to sit alone in a room, guzzle it down, and kill ourselves. Like every single person in this room that's over 21 could do that. You could do that. But why not? There's lots of reasons why not, right? Why don't we do that? It's legal. Nobody would stop us. You could just drive down in the car and, put it in your cart. You could be putting gallon after gallon of vodka in your cart, and The store clerk isn't going to be like, hey, what are you doing with all that vodka? You know, nobody's going to stop you. We could all do it. It's perfectly free. We have the power to do it. The only thing that's really stopping us would be money. And even in that case, some people would shoplift. You could shoplift. But why not? Why don't we do that? What do you think? Well, God doesn't approve, sure. Yeah, God loves us. Why would we do something so horrible to somebody that we love? And so we, on some level, we're like, ooh, I don't want to do that to my body. I don't want to do that to my life. You've got connections with friends, connections with family, connections with a church, connections with a community, and you don't want to harm yourself. So you stop yourself. You know, maybe it's not that difficult to stop yourself from that. You know, I've never like sought out to, you know, just, you know, guzzle down enough stuff to kill me. But anyway, so we believe that we're valuable. And so we stop. But the trouble is that value is on a continuum from, like, there's worthless on the one end, and then there's like of inestimable value and just like priceless worth on the other end. And some of us are a little bit, you know, we're closer to this end, you know, so we know that we're not worthless, but we also don't think that we're all that great or special. So we have a hard time. The truth is that we are priceless. But do we believe that about ourselves? And do we believe that about our family? There was a Focus on the Family segment that I listened to where the man had had an affair and it destroyed his family and his relationships and his marriage. And he said, what I would give to go back. I did not really value my family and took so much for granted. What I would give to have my family as it was before. The trust of my wife. My daughter not having contempt for me whenever she saw my face. All those things became cheap or worthless in my eyes when I was in that place. And I would pay any price to have that back. So some of the times what we do have is we don't treat it like it's valuable. We don't treat our family members like they're valuable. We don't treat ourselves like we're valuable. And that's how you do things that are terrible things. Yeah, so, you know, that's the one thing that a lot of the travesties against humanity have in common. If you think about slavery, if you think about the Holocaust, if you think about genocides, what do you have to do something like that? You have to demote someone from human, you know, fellow human to less than human. You have to. There's no way you could do that to your fellow man if you believed that they were valuable. You couldn't do it. So you have to say, well, you know, I'm able to overpower you and hold you prisoner, and I'm going to sell you to some slave traders and send you on a ship. So I have the power to do that. I'm going to sell you, and I can do that to you. And then as the person buying the slaves, you can say, oh, well, I can have this because I have more money and more power than you, and I can control what you do. If you read the stories about some of the genocides, like there was the genocide in Rwanda, it's incredible. Apparently, this is why belief is so important, because apparently the number one place for killing people was in churches, and it was people even, you know, it didn't matter what your religion was, whether you were Catholic or Protestant or even Seventh-day Adventists. There were Seventh-day Adventists who were brought up for war crimes, you know, which is just, it seems unbelievable. But if they look at the situation, if you read more about it, you'll see that the one thing that the people who participated in the genocide had in common is they believed very strongly in authority and in power and in obedience, and that God was to be obeyed, and you must do what he says. And the people who viewed God as a loving God, a God that wants to have a relationship with you, one that thinks that you're valuable, those are the people who didn't participate in it. So what we believe has such a profound impact on what we do and how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. And I'll talk a little briefly about my own journey. You know, when I first came into the church, I was really I was very, very legalistic, and I don't. I think that, you know, it's important to be obedient, but why are you being obedient? That's the important part. You know, why are you trying to obey God? What's driving that? And I remember just being terribly afraid of God's disapproval, that God was going to be ashamed of me if I failed him. And I talked a bit about shame one of the times that I was here, but so I was very, very strict. I remember ordering pizza, and I was very particular with my friends. They had pepperoni on one side and I had pineapple on one side, which I was very, very uncomfortable with, and that sort of really filled me with a lot of fear, like, you know, what if some of the oil slips over onto my side of the pizza? And then when one day I was talking with we were making the order, and I said, and make very sure that the pepperonis are completely on one other half, that they're not like halfway on the other half, so that when you slice through it, then you got like a little pepperoni that's on the pineapple side. Yeah, exactly. Oh, I know, I'm getting there. My wife knows this story. She knows where I'm going. So my roommate Robbie was like, Bill, I don't know why you're making such a big deal about this. They run through it with the same knife, so the same knife is cutting through the pepperoni anyway, so it's going through both sides anyway. And so I sat there blinking for a long time, and everyone in the room started groaning. They're like, Robbie, why did you do that? Don't you realize what this means? You've just complicated pizza night even more than it was already. And I said, I don't know what I can do. How will I be able to eat pizza with you? And the solution that they came up with to appease me, and this is how tortured I was, is said, okay, Bill, we'll get a knife from the kitchenette. We'll tell the pizza place to not cut it. And then when it arrives, then we'll cut it, and we'll be very careful. We don't cut through that pepperoni. And so when I look at that, and I look back on it, and really there was like a fear. There was a fear of God that was a very immature fear, kind of the fear that you have for your parents when you're a child. You know, when you're a young child, you're a little bit scared when your mom and dad are really upset with you, you know. And I think some of that fear is a little normal, like if you do something you knew you shouldn't have been doing and mom and dad find out about it and now you're in trouble. So, you know, a certain amount of that fear is normal. But anyway, I was very afraid of God. And there were some good things about that stage in my life because I was so diligent. I remember I was leading like two Bible studies a night two Bible studies a week. And in addition to that, I was doing a Bible study on Friday as part of a student ministry group. And I was just reading my Bible constantly because I said, you got to be ready. The end could come tomorrow like a thief in the night. And so that really pushed me to read my Bible. So I went from being 17 and knowing absolutely nothing about the Bible. I'd never read any of it to like arguing with people who'd been in the church all their lives. And I remember them telling me like, how do you know so much? And, you know, and I said, well, you know, don't you know the Bible? Jesus is coming soon? You know, like you have to be ready, you know. So I was constantly like, so there was some benefits to that time in my life, but it was not a sustainable time to be that legalistic. And the sad thing is you know that verse in I think it's Matthew 25, maybe, or 23. I can't remember where the woes are, the chapter of, I think it's 23, that he says, you know, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, for you travel far and wide to make one convert, one proselyte, and you make him twice the son of hell as you are. And that's the people that I brought into the church. There was one person in particular that began policing me about everything I was doing wrong. And I had worked very hard to stabilize my life to where I could not, no amount of myself could leak out, and where people could see that I wasn't all perfect and I didn't have it all together. So I had a problem with board games. When I would lose, I would get really bent out of shape, like very, like I'd yell and I'd you know, make a real fool of myself. And I concluded these board games are from Satan. That's what it is. It's gambling. It's related to gambling. There's dice. And so no more board games. And I refused to play board games with my friends. And I went through a very holy period where I only thought about holy things. And look, my temper went away. It's gone. But then I got married. And it came back. And I spent the first several years of my marriage thinking, it's my wife. That's the problem. See, my temper went away. Then she comes in the picture. My temper comes back. And that's a real pagan way of thinking. It's a pagan way. It's sort of like the the lady moves into town and she uses herbal teas and things, and then your crops wither, and you go, oh, it's a witch, you know, burn her, you know. So it's that kind of primitive pagan thinking that we still have in us. And so, I remember the things that they would police me about. They'd say, well, you know, don't you know what Sister White says about cinnamon? And they'd be policing me, you know, because I love cinnamon rolls, and they'd be policing me on that. And then I remember I had a Ninja Turtle shirt from my sister. My sister and I had a really bad relationship growing up. She was probably the most cruel person that I knew. I don't know if you have a relationship with a sibling like that, but don't raise your hands. But I hated my sister Mary, and she didn't seem to like me all that much either. And I remember after she had a baby, and I was watching my nephew for her, and I was, you know, taking care of him and stuff. Like, I softened toward my sister. I thought, you know, like, something this sweet could come from my sister, and then maybe she's not all bad or whatever. And I remember, you know, a little bit later, she bought me a Ninja Turtle shirt as a thank you for my birthday, and it, you know, because I really loved Ninja Turtles when I was a kid, and I wore it around the dorms. And then my convert, who is just a policeman, you think about policemen in the sky, they were worse because they were across the hall, and he would say, well, don't you know about, isn't that violent programming? They fight in that show, and it's violent. You know, aren't you promoting violence by wearing that? That's the trouble of having such a legalistic standard where you're like trying to promote how righteous and holy you are to other people. You're not just being. It's one thing if you're just, you love Jesus and you love other people and you're just nice to them. And you know, because that's something that David Asherick says about Jesus, is that the Sadducees hated Jesus because he was conservative. But the Pharisees hated Jesus because he was nice. And so you can be obedient to God without being cruel to other people. So anyway, but that's what I did. So I raised this big standard, and I was really focused on being as righteous as looking as possible. And people don't like that. They want to try to find out your secrets. They want to try to expose you. And the truth was that I was in a really dark place in my life. I was really, really having a very hard time. And every time I failed, that was a time that God was away from me, that God didn't love me anymore, and I better repent, or else maybe if I get hit by a car on my way out the dorm, or, you know, somebody wasn't paying attention, they could hit me with a car, and then I'd be lost forever, and I'd be gone. And that was I called it yo-yo salvation. So I'd be like saved, and I surrender all, and I believe you, Jesus, and then I'm lost forever, and then, oh, wait, I'm saved again, oh, and then I'm lost, and I failed. And that kind of roller coaster life is a misery. It really is. It's a miserable thing. And like I said, you know, that those things that I believed about God, I do things like missing communion, which is one of the most stupid things that you could do if your life is out of order. The best and safest place for you if your life is out of order is to be around other people that love you and care for you. And you should form those kind of relationships in the church. You know, there are people in the church that are closer to me than my own family. They know me more than, and I can be myself around them more than I can be myself around my family, because there's a lot of judgment, you know, that might happen. So, you know, so it's really something that, you know, you got to believe that you're valuable. And so I'll close with a story. You know, I remember 1 John 3. There's a lot of times, I'm glad you read it. Is it Hope? I'm glad you read it in the New International Version. I think that's a better translation. But they don't, because the older translation doesn't catch the practice part. I remember reading this, and it says, "He that commits sin is of the devil, and whosoever is born of God does not sin." And I remember reading that, and it was horrifying to me, because I thought, man, if that's God's standard, I better be perfect, and I better watch out, because if I sin even once, I'm of the devil. That's where I belong, and I belong in hell. And so I was constantly like afraid of that. I remember somebody was telling me, well, that really means habit. That really means, like, you know, if you practice sin, that sin is like the unbroken pattern of your life. And I was like, whatever, liberal. That's what I just dismissed it. Like, whatever, you're crazy. You know, you just want an excuse to sin and do whatever you want. And so you're just going to, like, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's about practice. And so I just wrote off what they said. And then I was like, I'm going to go to the Strong's Concordance. And I looked up the concordance and I said, look, it just means do. Do sin. So if you do sin, you're of the devil. And I didn't get, it doesn't say anything in here about habit or practice or whatever. And eventually you run yourself ragged thinking like that, having the yo-yo salvation. You just run yourself ragged and it wears you out. And so I eventually got to a point where I didn't know where I was as far as the Bible is concerned about that passage. I was like, I don't know where I am in that story. I just don't want to look at it. So I just won't read that passage for a while. And then it wasn't until I was teaching grammar to a group of level one students, and I was teaching them the present tense. And this was maybe, 2014? This was a long time ago. No, even before that. This was like 2011, 2012. I was teaching the present tense. And I don't know if you realize this, but we don't actually use the present tense for the present tense. Like, we say things like, you know, what are you doing? I'm going to the store. Like, I am going. We don't say, I go to the store. That makes you sound like a knight at Camelot or something. I go to the store. Yea, verily, forsooth. You know, and you go to the store, you know. So we use the present tense for facts, for habits, and for routines. Like, the sun rises in the west and sets, or rises in the east and sets in the west. You might use a routine. You might say, I take a shower before bed every night, or I take showers at bedtime. So when you use the present tense, it does have that idea about that's the habit. You know, I can say I don't eat pork. Okay. Now, while I was in Korea, there was a mysterious breakfast sandwich I was offered by my students, and you know, I don't know what it was, to be honest. I didn't want to ask to make it rude. But that statement about me is still pretty true. You know, like, I don't eat pork. I don't go out and buy it. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, that would describe me. So that's when I really started to understand what that passage was about. It's about sin, and it's about your habit, your routine. Is sin the unbroken pattern of your life? And the truth is, if you're a Christian, if you're born again and the Spirit of God dwells in you, you won't be able to live like that. It will be miserable. You will have a truly miserable life, because there's really, it's like you know that you're not doing right. You know that it's not good what you're doing. And so you won't be able to continue like that. And you almost have to like force yourself to keep going. And so granted, there's going to be a lot of character growth and development during that. And but what do we believe about God? And I'll close with a story that I learned in fatherhood. I think fatherhood has probably taught me more about God than any book has ever done. And there also aren't very many books on fatherhood. I was trying to get my kid to learn how to ride a bike. And my first son, it took him like 6 months to learn, because there's a lot of starting and stopping and starting and stopping. And my wife is very big on like, don't, you know, they shouldn't be forced. Don't force them to do it. One day, you know, there was somebody that I knew that was in their 20s and didn't know how to ride a bike, because their mom never made them do it. And I was thinking, well, I know that they can't be forced, but somebody's got to get them on that bike and learn them. So I made it my goal. I said, today, I sat down with my son, Sammy, and I said, we're going to learn how to ride a bike. And he's like, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. And he was really, really upset about it. And he was very afraid. And I said, you can do it. You actually have it in you. You don't know it, but you have it in you. You can ride a bike. And he said, no, I can't. I can't do it. I'm no good at that. I'm no good at riding a bike. And he was just very stubborn and very obstinate and just wouldn't listen. And I tried to temper what I wanted to do with what my wife wanted to do, because I think there's always a tension between the mother and the father. The mother wants to keep their children safe. And I remember when I first wrestled around with my son, it drove my wife crazy. She's like, oh, I don't like that you're throwing, you know, I'd pick him up and throw him on the couch, and we'd, you know, wrestle around the living room. But it's good for kids. They need that. They need that. I mean, but, you know, we can get carried away. But anyway, so I'm out there with the bike, and I said, here's the deal. I'm going to try and balance this. So let's go up and down the alley three times. When we go up and down the alley, then we can be done for the day, and we'll do three times tomorrow. And so he's like, you know, didn't even say anything. It was just a kind of like groan deep from within. And so, you know, I put him on the bike, and then he's going along, and I'm pushing him along, and then he fell and hurt his knee, and that was not good. And I picked him back up, got him on the bike again, and he fell again. And then he fell again. And then he fell again. And I think we were halfway through the first alley, the first thing, because it was supposed to be there and back three times. And we were halfway through, like, the alley, and he'd fallen, like, 10 times. It was really embarrassing, and I felt bad for him. And I was like, come on, you can do it, you can do it. And at one point, he just stopped cooperating at all, just wouldn't cooperate. And I had to move his legs like a puppet, you know, and I said, okay, I will be with you. I'll move you down the alley myself. And he was very, very upset with me. Then I had him go by himself a little bit more. I think, okay, he's got it now. He's got it. And then he falls again. So I thought, you know, that's not good. And I knew that I had to ignore his crying and get him back on there. So I put him back on there, and he fell again. And he said, I don't like this, Daddy. I can't do this. And I said, you can do it. One more time he falls, and this time I'm like, you're doing great, you're doing great. And he popped me in the nose as hard as he could. Just brought his fist down. He was about 4 years old at the time. This was a couple years ago. And he just cracked me real hard and, like, bent my glasses, and my nose was hurting so bad. It was in broad daylight. The neighbors could see. And at that point, I felt so angry. And I leaned into his face, and I said, we were going to do three times and be done. Now we're going to do 20. And I don't know if you've ever made a bargain like that as a parent, but you almost think, like, that was a little stupid. Because I'm sitting there like pushing him like this, you know, so my back is just killing me. And, you know, I'm going down and I'm thinking, I got to do that 20 times, which is really 40, you know, down the alley, then back. That's one, down the alley, then back. That's one, that's two. And so I thought, like, I bit off more than I could chew, and what's going to happen if he doesn't know it? And I thought, like, gosh, you know, so then we go through, I think probably the next 10 times, it was just me setting him on the bike and doing the puppet legs and just rotating him and stuff. And then finally, it got to around time number 18 that I was pushing him down the alley with just my thumb, where he could feel that my hand was there. But he didn't, he thought I'm pushing him, but he's actually doing it completely by himself. And just, there's just my thumb on his back. And we got to the end, and he stumbled a little at the end, and I said, you did it. And he said, no, I didn't. You were holding me. And I said, no, I just had my thumb on your back. Did you, you did it. You did it. You can do it. And he said, He just looked at me. And I said, let's go a couple more times. And a couple more times, and it was just my thumb guiding him. And he's going up and down, up and down. And then on time number 19, he got real mad because he fell a couple times and then yelled at me. And I said, we're going to go one more time in the backyard once we're all done for that. And then after that, he was very restrained. And he was I could tell the wheels were turning in his head. And he knew that he had to control his temper. And so anyway, so we get through the 20 runs. At that point, I knew he could do it, and our yard is on a slight incline. So I said, once we go in the backyard, he'll do it. And we got in the backyard, and I gave him a little bit of a push, and he rode his bike all by himself. He rode it all the way around our yard, and when he came back around, he looked at me, and he said, Daddy, I did it! I did it! I did it! And I said, yeah, you did. And I called for Daria, and I called for Charlie. And I said, guys, get out of here, get out of here. Because they couldn't be outside while I was going through the 20 runs. It was so miserable. And I thought, man, someone's going to call the police on me. Like, this is so embarrassing. He's just at one point just wailing and slumped in the bicycle. And I'm just holding him. But he's like, I did it, Daddy, I did it. And then I showed Daria and he got on his bike all by himself, and he rode around the backyard, and he was just so proud. He was just so proud, and it was like that obstinate, stubborn, hapless little boy was gone, and a new little boy took his place. And I couldn't tell enough people how proud of him I was, and all the frustration and all the all the back bending and walking at a perpendicular angle and even the punch in the nose, all of it was worth it. And I said, you know, that's my son, and he did it, he did it. And I started thinking, you know, that's something that's close to the story of the prodigal son. You know, the son returns and the father runs to him and he loves him. And that's more, if I feel that way, then I know that God has to feel a lot more like that than I do, and a lot less selfish than I am. And so I want to leave you with that story that you can believe, and I want you to believe that God is on your side, that he loves you, and he sees things in you that you don't see yourself. You know, a lot of us talk about, oh, Enoch is so great, blah, blah, blah. You could be an Enoch. You know, you may not believe that, but you could be a Job. You could be an Enoch. You could be a Joseph. You could, although Joseph was a bit of a bragger. He really was. When you know, when you think about it, like, people are always like, Joseph, he never sinned. And it's like, if you've got a lot of brothers and you walk in, you're like, guys, I had another dream, and you were all bowing to me. And so I don't think Joseph was without his faults, but he still a pretty good example. But I want to encourage you to believe that God wants good things for you, and that he's there stumbling along next to you and trying to keep you on the bike, and that's something that is missing from a lot of people's experiences. If you don't believe God loves you even when you're failing, then that can be very hard. And before I close, I want to make sure I cover the Christian standards thing, because I know people are going to be like, well, that just means you can do whatever you want then, and that it doesn't matter if you sin. And I always laugh when people say that, because actually it makes me feel pretty good when people say that, because if you read Romans chapter 6, that's the accusation that was levied against Paul, that Paul said, you know, are we saying that let us then sin, since grace may abound, you know? So if people are accusing me of that, that means, okay, I must be saying something that's partially right. That makes me feel pretty good. But I'll try to appease the legalist among us, so, because I don't know who might be of that mindset. But I guess I will just say this, like, trying your, like, kind of like a struggle I had one time where I sort of realized, okay, if God is love, then that means he can't really be bad to us. That's all he is love. And so, gosh, that's not fair, because God is love, so he can be all loving, and he asks us to be loving, but he's not. But that's all that he is, so he can't really do anything different. And God spoke to me. He said, well, is it going to be making sense to be anything else? You know, if you really think about it, does it make sense to be anything else? Does it make sense? If you could be doing better, you could be doing good things, does it make sense to do anything else? You know, does it make sense to say, I'm not going to strive for the best? I'm not going to strive to be the best person I can be. I want to be the best son, the best daughter, the best husband, the best wife, the best mother, the best father, the best brother, the best sister, the best church member. If it doesn't make sense to think anything else, like, what are you going to do? Say, well, I'll keep these nasty habits of mine, and I'll just fix up the other things, but these nasty ones I'll keep around. Like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense. Like, if you really have been redeemed by Jesus, you're going to do everything you can, and it will change your life. Jesus will change your life. So, I think I'll end there. That with those two things, I hope that you don't believe that you're entitled to good things, and I hope that you don't believe you're entitled to bad things. I hope that you believe that God loves you, and that you are valuable, and that the people around you are valuable, and that God can use us, and we're far tougher than we think we are, and we're capable of a lot more than God thinks we are, or that we think we are, and that God knows us inside and out, and he knows that we're destined for great things, and he has big plans for us. And I hope that the next time you're failing, you know that God is right by your side, ready to dust you off and pick you back up and get you going again. You know, for the righteous man falls seven times, but rises again. And I'll end there. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share God's word with you.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.